the Development Policy Centre podcast. In this episode, we bring you our panel on aid to the Pacific from the 2015 Australasian Aid Conference. You can see the presentations on our website, devpolicy.anu.edu.au.
Okay, so let's get started on this session, which is about aid to the Pacific. And firstly, let me introduce myself. I'm Jenny Durin, and I'm an Assistant Secretary in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade. I work in the Pacific Division on Pacific issues. And I'm joined by three very distinguished panellists, John Negan, Stephen Close and Matthew Dornan. And I'll introduce them all in turn as they get up to speak. We'll have their presentations one after the other, and then we'll open it up to questions. Before I introduce Joel, let me also acknowledge and thank both the ANU and the Development Policy Centre for the focus that they have on Pacific studies here over a long period of time. And that's not just a reflection of the institution, but it's also a reflection of the individuals and their long-standing interest in these issues. And I know many of you have also been working on the Pacific for some, so this should be a very interesting session. I hope it's lively, and I hope you've got some good questions planned. So let me get on and introduce our first speaker. Joel is Associate Professor and Director of Research in the School of Public Health at the University of Sydney. He'll be known to many of you. I asked him for some brief bio details. He gave me one line. He's worked on health and development projects in Africa and the Pacific for the past 14 years. Those of you who know Joel also know that he has a strong and broad interest in development policy and public health. He's an active contributor to policy fora like the Development Policy Centre. I read his blogs because they're interesting. And he has a good stock of research and publications under his belt. So please welcome Joel.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. Very excited to be part of this session with Stephen and Matt and Jenny. And we're talking about some fairly broad different parts of aid to the Pacific and development in the Pacific, so hopefully we'll raise some questions both in each talk and then across them as well. So my short talk today is recapping some work that I did a few years ago and that we've started to update over the last few months. And the question is, all talk and no action, has the Pacific regional health architecture improved over the last 5 years? So we will go through that. So this is meant to scare you. And you're supposed to look at this and rub your eyes a little bit and go, oh my goodness, that looks horrible. Because essentially it is. This is some work that was released recently by Chatham House, and it's purported to present to you all the major global health actors around the world. And I think they identified 203 major global health actors, ranging from NGOs like CARE and Médecins Sans Frontières, multilaterals like World Health Organization and UNICEF, bilateral agencies, funders like Gavi and the Global Fund, Gates Foundation, think tanks, universities, etc. They had two or three from Australia, and the two or three that they had from Australia are not the ones that I would have put for Australia, so I think you could easily put a bunch more onto this and keep it, make it even more robust. They tried to do here kind of links between the various ones, but basically what it shows is a proliferation of global health architecture, actors, meetings, mechanisms, groups, and increasing complexity. Even the effort to write and draw this slide by Chatham House was probably incredibly complex, let alone trying to actually navigate what it means and its implications. So I present that as a scary story, but it's actually the result of quite a positive situation. There has been a huge amount of increase in funding available for global health activities globally, from around $6 billion in 1990 up to more than $30 billion per year. And this is US dollars, and this is pulled together by the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation at University of Washington. So it's a very positive story, and we should be very happy to see this. But the increased funding and the proliferation have gone hand in hand. And so this is from that Chatham House report, the number of new global health actors by decade. And we see right around 1990 that huge increase in the 90s and then in the early 2000s of the global health actors. I like this slide again because it's just a bit scary. Pulled it together a few years ago with a starting point from someone else, but just showing a random sample of some of those mechanisms. And you look at them all individually and they all kind of make sense. I'm glad that there's someone who is working on a future free of lymphatic filariasis. And maybe there should be a global alliance for lymphatic filariasis. And there's the International AIDS Vaccine Initiative, and there's the International Trachoma Initiative, and there's the Mectazan Donation Program, and so on and so forth. And each of these are worthy causes, but then you turn around and all of a sudden you have a very complex map of different actors all clamoring for money, for attention, for the ear of the Minister of Health or the Permanent Secretary. And that's where we start to get into in this work. I like this quote by the ex-Minister of Health and now the head of UNFPA. When I was asked for a briefing on malaria, I was given a briefing by funding streams. I asked myself, is WHO dealing with a different strain of malaria to the Global Fund? And for those of you who've worked in ministries of health in various countries, they will say, so here's what USAID is doing, here's what Global Fund's doing, here's what Gavi is doing, rather than saying, here's what our plan is for malaria, or here's what our plan is for whatever the case may be. And in work in the Solomon Islands, the malaria situation is very much like this, where you say, what's happening with malaria in the Solomon Islands? Say, well, Rotary's doing this, and JICA's doing this, and DFAT's doing this, and we're doing this, and Global Fund's doing that. And they don't kind of then say, and therefore that means that this is the story overall. That part always gets somehow left off. So taking that as the context, we wanted to look at the Pacific as a microcosm of this complex global health landscape, acknowledging, as you would all know, the additional challenges of working in the Pacific. Small populations, large distances, limited capacity, and disparate cultures. And so perhaps in a foolish fit of logic, we looked at the Pacific Aid Effectiveness Principles. And I imagine I'm one of the few people to have looked at the Pacific Aid Effectiveness Principles, because I don't think they get pulled out all that often anymore, but they did exist and they did get agreed to in 2000 and something, seven or eight perhaps. And so I've highlighted in red there some of the key points that were raised: country ownership, countries aligned to nationally identified priorities, specific ownership, coordinated and harmonized approach, increased use of local systems, national ownership. I mean, there's a real theme coming out here. And so what we wanted to look at, with this commitment on top of the Paris Declaration, has that been the reality in the Pacific? So initially in 2010, funded by the AusAid-funded Nossal Institute Knowledge Hub, we examined regional health governance in the Pacific, and we reviewed documents and interviewed policymakers, both multilaterals, bilateral, Pacific ministers of health, permanent secretaries, other people working in the region. And the hypothesis was that increased aid had led to many more mechanisms and stakeholders, complexity had increased, and effectiveness of the various mechanisms was unclear. So these are just some of the Pacific ones. You might think, logically, that the Pacific Senior Health Officials Network and the Pacific Island Health Officers Association are the same thing, but in fact, they're two separate bodies, one for the South Pacific, one for the North Pacific, with a bit of overlap here and there. You might think that PIDJAG, the Pacific Islands Jurisdiction AIDS Action Group, should work closely with the Oceania Society for Sexual Health and HIV Medicine, but you would be largely incorrect, and so on. So you already start to see on that kind of global complexity playing out in the Pacific, which is a region of, depending on how you count it, 10 million people and some countries that are very, very small. So our study identified 66 regional health mechanisms with a wide variety of technical emphases, geographic focus, mandates, and purposes. And everyone agreed that it added to workloads, raises questions regarding the quality of governance and the effectiveness of these mechanisms. So just as an example, the HIV mechanism meetings in 2009. I'll read these out because it's kind of amusing. Pacific Islands Regional Multi-Country Coordinating Mechanism, Pacific Islands HIV and STI Response Fund Committee, PERSIP HIV Annual Joint Implementation Meeting, Pacific Islands Jurisdiction AIDS Action Group, Oceania Society for Sexual Health and HIV Medicine, and then a bunch of other ones as well coming from North Pacific because of US funding. As well as WHO one-off meetings, a meeting of focal persons for the prevention and control of STIs and HIV, and so on. So these are just, in the Pacific, in 1 year, the HIV-focused meetings. Ignoring PNG for a second, this is also in a part of the world where there are very, very few cases of HIV. When I mentioned this to a policymaker, one of the donors, they said, yes, but perhaps there are so few cases of HIV in the region because we have so many meetings. And I said, that's an interesting point you raise, causality. But perhaps he wasn't an epidemiologist or biostatistician, but fair point. Now, I'm indebted to my colleague, Rob Condon, who somehow made this, trying to decipher which countries are in which of the groupings. So the Global Fund, SBC projects, at the time, AusAid-funded projects, UNAIDS jurisdiction, and so on. And as you can see, that makes a lot of logical sense and helps harmonization tremendously with the clarity that comes from that. So I'm joking about it, but it has a major impact on how health work is done in the region. Some of these bodies are technical, some are professional networking, some are grant oversight bodies, but it adds to complexity. And I guess what's really important is that it pulls people away from their day job. So when we interviewed Pacific Island managers, PSs and so on, directors of public health, they were pulled away from their desks so often. Now, if this situation was happening in Kenya, where the Ministry of Health has hundreds of people, and there are a number of HIV specialists and a number of diabetes specialists and a number of child health specialists, then being pulled to various meetings, well, that's unfortunate, but at least you're being pulled to meeting periodically. But if you are the HIV coordinator for a Pacific Island country, you're probably also the STI coordinator, you're probably also the TB coordinator, and you might also be the malaria coordinator. And all of a sudden, you're getting pulled to a huge number of meetings. And in some cases, you're flying not on five flights a day between your capital city and Manila, but rather one flight every 3 or 4 days. You have to fly via some other place. And so the actual amount of days that it takes, you might go for a three-day meeting, but you might be out of the office for 7 or 8 days. And so a few of the people we spoke to were out of the office 50% of their time or more. And then some of their other time, they're out visiting the provinces and so on. So it adds up, they're never at their desk. So when we talk about Pacific time and people not getting back to you, it might not be Pacific time. It might be that they're in Manila. And that's why they're not getting back to you. So are there some benefits to this? Of course there are. The Tanoa Hotel in Nadi. It benefits tremendously. Air Pacific, Brisbane Airport Transfer Lounge. More seriously, networking and solidarity, sharing of information, and of course, per diems. It's very true that people have a significant boost to their income from per diems from these types of visits. Part of it is professional jealousy. I don't get invited to these things because I say things like this, so I don't get such per diems, and I'm jealous. And then costs, of course, time, money, complexity, paralysis, and fragmentation. So my time's probably running, so I'll go through this fairly quickly. But we did propose a few recommendations around streamlining health governance for your meetings, more harmonization, more specific ownership of the agendas, more smaller sub-regional consultations, and also more effort to take the ideas that are, when you pull one person to a meeting and he goes to a meeting for 3 or 4 days, you have to then bring that person and those ideas back to the country. And one person bringing the ideas back, it means it's not localized, it's not owned locally. And so a lot of times these meetings just weren't, the impact of the meeting wasn't being felt. Now there is some good news here. After this report, DFAT did take a lot of these ideas, not just from us, but from other discussions, and developed a regional health program delivery strategy, which argued for a more focused and strategic regional mechanisms, argued for more national level assistance, and using regional approaches only for activities that require a regional approach. So there was a step change in thinking. So for some things, you do need a regional approach in the Pacific, or at least you could argue strongly for one. Maybe health worker training, maybe an influenza response. That makes sense to have a regional response. But there are things like diabetes, for example. That's a national issue that happens to affect many countries in the region. But still, diabetes is not something that you approach from a regional perspective. It's still a national issue. And I think the architecture had gotten that wrong. said everything's a regional issue because it impacts multiple countries in the region, but that's not actually true. So I think they've started to kind of come around on that. And so what we wanted to do is try and see, has there been positive steps in the interim few years? So we did a rapid review of the 2014 meetings and mechanisms, and we started to interview some of the policymakers in the Pacific and a few others who know about the architecture to try and get a sense if things have gotten better. So this is a kind of rapid review. We do hope to do a more robust one over the coming months. So a number of meetings were still occurring, and that's perhaps not a bad thing. We still have some of these meetings going on, NCD Forum, Pacific Ministers of Health meeting, Pacific Island Health Officer Association, and so on. So some meetings continuing. Still a huge number of WHO one-off technical meetings. So there were 14 one-off technical meetings hosted by WHO in 2009, and in 2014 there were 23 of them. So whereas DFAT was saying we need to harmonize a bit more, WHO had actually expanded their number of one-off meetings. And you see some of them here, and each of them you could certainly argue have their value, but it does mean that more and more people are being pulled out for meetings. And a lot of the meetings that WHO holds are ones for the whole WIPRO region, which means you have someone from Tonga in the meeting with someone from Mongolia, and someone from Nauru in the meeting with people from South Korea, talking about issues as if they all need the same kind of information. And that perhaps is not the case. Some good progress in the HIV world. There have been good efforts to harmonize the various HIV mechanisms. Part of that is because DFAT has stopped funding some of them, so they've started to harmonize a bit. But it also means that that has catalyzed some actors in the region to put HIV not as its own silo, but to merge it with sexually transmitted infections, reproductive health, sexual health. And so now there's efforts to create one kind of cross-group category there, and rather than have this hyper-siloed type of different mechanisms, to rather have it all under one umbrella. So that has been some positive steps. It's still happening. It still hasn't all kind of bedded down, but there has been some progress in that sense. So overall, there has been some good progress. SBC has kind of acknowledged that its regional approach wasn't working, and it's tried to think a little bit more about national approaches and harmonizing its regional thinking. DFAT's taken some good steps. There's been declines in funding, which might have a positive byproduct in terms of harmonization or reduction in mechanisms. WHO is still not really on board with this alignment agenda. So then this last slide, I'm not sure how I'm doing time-wise, but last slide. That didn't work. Oh, sorry, I just want to make a point. The current situation leaves us with multiple actors jockeying for position and funding, with the fragmentation benefiting advocates more than implementers. And I think that's important because noisier people end up getting more attention. And it doesn't have to do with strategy. It has to do with everyone jockeying for position and the noisy one. And if I have a second, I'll just tell a quick anecdote from my time in Kenya. I was working with the National AIDS Commission there, and we had 40 or 50 different stakeholders, donors, Global Fund, NGOs. And there was one person who always came to the meeting, a young Kenyan man, who advocated so noisily for HIV among people who are disabled, people who are blind or disabled. And he used to come to every meeting and stamp his fist on the table and rant for a good 10 minutes, to the point where the National AIDS Commission basically added people living with disability into the national HIV strategy so that this person would not rant at these meetings. He never brought evidence about the percentage of people with disability in Kenya or the percentage of people with disability in Kenya who are HIV positive, but this person was so noisy and everyone rolled their eyes when he started ranting and raving that they said, we'll put it into the strategy just to keep this person quiet. And that's a sign that noise and advocacy, and I think those of you who are advocates in the room, great job, but it does mean that sometimes advocacy trumps funding and strategy, and that's potentially dangerous. Last word to a colleague from the Pacific. It is time to take a hard look at the way health aid is currently delivered in the Pacific and determine if it is resulting in better, sustainable care based upon improved outcomes. Is the program building health system strength from its foundation upward? Can we craft a new agreement on how to best facilitate this in countries like the Solomon Islands by merging the current piecemeal aid into a comprehensive multinational partnership with the host nation overseeing the program? And I think that's a fair question to leave ourselves with. Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Joel. If you're wondering why I'm sitting down there, it's because I can eyeball the speakers and go time. But you did well on time there, Joel. Our next speaker is Stephen Close. As well as being an ex-colleague, Stephen is a human development specialist at the World Bank and a PhD candidate here at ANU in the State Society and Governance in Melanesia program. At the bank, his role is to focus on second chance education, workforce development and education sector management in Pacific countries. He's just returned from the Solomon Islands, and his PhD research is a very interesting topic, the politics of public policy on employment in Pacific Island countries. And Stephen's going to be speaking about tertiary scholarships. Thanks, Stephen.
I may not be as efficient on time as Joel, I hope I am, but there are more pretty pictures to look at. There was a really interesting commonality with Joel's presentation, which I'll come to hopefully in conclusion if I remember. I'd just like to start with a disclaimer. I'm not representing the World Bank in this presentation. I have my ANU PhD hat on, just in case there are any members of Parliament from Pacific Island countries in the room. The research focus of my study is what factors explain institutional responses to youth employment in Pacific Island countries. And this particular case study of research on government expenditure on overseas tertiary scholarships in Pacific Island countries is a case study of that institutional response to youth employment. So to set the scene, as some of you who've worked in the education sector in international development assistance will be aware, there's been a significant focus in the last couple of decades on the Millennium Development Goals and Education for All. The focus has been on access to universal basic education, and in recent years there's been an increasing focus on the quality of that basic education. Once indicators had improved in low-income countries for access of poor populations to primary education, the donors started to recognise that, in fact, people weren't learning how to read and write in basic education as much as had been assumed. In the area of workforce development, it's very important to recognise the importance of demand. If we're going to support people in the transition from education into employment, it's important that education is responsive to labour demand. But it's amazing for an education specialist like me to discover just how rarely that happens. Within the various subsectors of education, it can be considered that tertiary education has often missed out in the focus for low-income countries. Development partners have often said, well, we need to fix basic education and secondary education before we focus too much on tertiary education, which often benefits the more advantaged students in society. Yet there is a case for tertiary education, including in less developed countries. It's important for building skills and developmental leadership. It's important for building the skills and innovation for less developed countries to build their comparative advantage in certain economic areas to contribute to economic growth. It also has very important political and good governance aims because it's important in developing a developmental elite. It's important in building a sense of a nation, which is a particular priority in some Pacific Island countries, and it helps build a demand for good governance. So to look at the role of tertiary education in Pacific Island countries, we've come a long way since independence of countries like Solomon Islands, Vanuatu and Tuvalu. It's amazing to think that independence, Solomon Islands had three tertiary graduates and Tuvalu had two. These countries have significant development needs which require advanced professional and managerial skills, especially if they are to overcome long-term aid reliance. But there are problems for higher education delivery posed by small size, country remoteness, and the lack of economies of scale. These countries have needed to look overseas for tertiary education provision. The result of that has been a long-standing practice of Pacific Island governments allocating expenditure to overseas tertiary scholarships, which is supplemented by development partner-funded scholarships. Looking overall at Pacific Island countries' investment in education, Pacific countries do quite well. There's an international benchmark of 20% of government budget to education, which is regarded as good practice, and that was advocated by the Education for All Fast Track initiative in the 2000s. And if we see at the bottom of these range of Pacific and comparable low-income countries, Vanuatu, Tuvalu and Solomon Islands are consistently above the 20% benchmark for government budget. But there is a public policy challenge, because expenditure on tertiary education, in particular overseas tertiary scholarships, has increased rapidly in some Pacific Island states. And these exact same three Pacific Island states share these five common characteristics, which I'll explain in detail. Firstly, overseas tertiary scholarships absorb a large proportion of education funds and crowd out other sector expenditures. They undermine achievement of universal education goals. They're vulnerable to political compromise and weak management. They pose significant fiscal sustainability risk from exceeding budgets on a regular basis. And finally, they're highly inequitable, and they do not necessarily achieve the returns on the investment in economic growth or employment. So, looking at these three countries, in each of these three countries, overseas tertiary scholarships expenditure absorbs significant education funds. And this poses an opportunity cost because it crowds out other expenditures. This is visible in Tuvalu. If we see the table on the left, the top. This is a subsectoral breakdown of education expenditure, and in some years, the top proportion going to tertiary education was as much as 44% or 45%, and three quarters of that went to overseas tertiary scholarships. So, in a government budget the size of Tuvalu's, it is pretty straightforward to see that that amount of expenditure going from the education budget on tertiary education means there's not much left for primary education, about as low as 19% in some years. But unfortunately, 95 to 98% of that primary education expenditure goes on teacher salaries. And the result is that in some years, primary schools got as little as $37 or $50 Australian in operational expenses. In Solomon Islands, there's a 20% estimated functional literacy rate based on literacy surveying, but the government puts no budget into adult literacy, with the exception of certain years like last year when there was about $50,000 Australian put into adult literacy as a one-off contribution. Vocational education is the other side of tertiary education, but it is often neglected. Tertiary education in Solomon Islands gets between 2 and 4% of education budget, while university education attracts regularly 25 to 30% of education budget. And in Vanuatu, the overspend on tertiary scholarships was equivalent to the financing gap to achieving universal basic education. This expenditure undermines education goals. There are comprehensive education strategic frameworks in the three countries, but none plan for increased tertiary expenditure. Vanuatu and Solomon Islands in particular have extensive policies on every subsector of education, but many of these policy goals remain unachieved because of financing and capacity constraints at the same time that large proportions of expenditure go to tertiary scholarships. There's also an unfortunate complementarity of development budget underspend and tertiary scholarships overspend, and that's related to capacity issues. This often happens in Solomon Islands, where through the year, budget on learning materials or curriculum development or infrastructure development of schools is unspent, and that's then transferred to the overspend on politically selected tertiary scholarships. So, as you can see, overseas tertiary scholarships are affected by political compromise and weak management. It's widely recognised in Pacific Island countries that tertiary scholarship processes are politically influenced, and they have in fact become a tool of political patronage. While there are meritocratic selection processes for tertiary scholarships, these are often undermined at the last minute with a phone call from the Minister of Education. In Solomon Islands, they have in fact institutionalised Member of Parliament selected scholarships as part of the Constituency Scholarship Fund for MPs. But even those funds are exceeded and the Ministry of Education budget gets raided. The effect of this political process, which is a tug of war between bureaucrats and ministries of education and ministers of education and members of parliament, is that Solomon Islands and Vanuatu often only confirm their scholarships list after the start of the school year, and so regularly start at the University of South Pacific late. They go without allowances because there's no budget left in the Ministry of Education budget to pay the allowances that they're due. And underqualified and politically selected students either drop out or extend, therefore further exceeding the budget allocations for tertiary scholarships. This problem hasn't gone unidentified. As you can see on the left, there's been a high media profile in Solomon Islands and Vanuatu about corrupt tertiary scholarships practices. And students at studying at USP and at home in Vanuatu and Solomon Islands are very vocal when they don't get student allowances. There is also a significant fiscal risk, obviously, provided by this continual pattern of overexpenditure on tertiary scholarships. Politicisation imposes a cost. As we can see in this graph from the Pacific Institute of Public Policy in Vanuatu, each year over 2012 to 2014, there was a significant overspend of budget. Even when budget was significantly increased, tertiary scholarships caused the budget to be overspent by 70% in 2014. In Solomon Islands government budget statement for 2014, the Ministry of Finance recognised that the backflip by government to decide to provide free university education was the most significant risk to fiscal sustainability in the Solomon Islands. This represents that it's no longer become just an issue for Ministry of Education budget, but it's become an issue for national budget. Obviously, overseas tertiary scholarships expenditure is also highly inequitable. As we can see in these two graphs, there's comparison of per student expenditure at each level of education. In 2012 in Tuvalu, there was $753 per student spent on primary education, but about $24,000 Australian spent per student on in-service scholarships, which is scholarships for public servants. And in Solomon Islands, in Solomon Islands dollars, the per student tertiary expenditure was $45,000, while it was $800 Solomon per student in early childhood. These are among the highest tertiary per student costs in the world, and of course it's directed at a very small part of the student population. In Solomon Islands, tertiary students are 1% of the student population, but regularly they attract between 25 and 30% of government budget. And yet there's a question on whether this investment in tertiary scholarships yields a return on the investment, because four decades on from independence, most New Vanuatu and Solomon Islanders remain locked out of tertiary education and formal employment. To illustrate this, out of 25 Solomon Islanders, one will have a tertiary education. There are also efficiency problems in scholarship programs. In Tuvalu in 2012, 25 to 34% of overseas scholarship holders did not complete. When scholarship holders do graduate, they end up back in the public service. That doesn't actually reflect the makeup of formal employment. In Solomon Islands, two-thirds of formal employment is in the private sector, and yet only 29% of graduates go to the private sector. So it's quite possible that this return of scholarship holders to the public sector may be helping to develop a developmental elite, but there hasn't been a significant improvement in government capacity in many areas in Solomon Islands, and also this doesn't demonstrably improve employment creation for the majority of the population. So there are obvious political and social dynamics to this problem that need to be considered because to go beyond the economic problem. There's a broader political economy at play in Solomon Islands and Vanuatu of patronage politics and constituency funds, and this undermines the presence of a social contract between populations and states for service delivery through line ministries. Populations are more likely to go to their member of parliament or government minister for handouts, for instance, for student fees, than to expect the Ministry of Education to deliver education services. There are due processes for tertiary scholarships selection, but these are sidelined by ministerial intervention. Considering the constituency for tertiary scholarships, they're more likely to be urban, educated, public sector and vocal, whereas the constituency for community education and adult literacy is more likely to be rural, disempowered, and without access to public dialogue. We could be seeing an example of the educational elite in Pacific Island countries replicating itself through its control of expenditure decisions. There's also the issue that there's an absence of credit for education. It's quite logical and rational for middle-class families in Pacific Island countries to turn to government to fund tertiary education when there is no access to credit to pay for tertiary education opportunities. There may also be a role of traditional safety nets at play here. It could be that there's a broader constituency in these societies for government expenditure on tertiary scholarships benefiting an elite if that broader network of family and village connections are going to benefit once a relative gains public sector employment as a result of that tertiary scholarship. For instance, in Honiara, they may move into Honiara and stay with a family member's household and benefit from allowances and salary shared from that public sector employment. So to look at some of the emerging responses to this public policy challenge from officials in government and from development partners, the key actors have been Ministry of Education officials who are concerned about their budget, Ministry of Finance officials who are concerned about the effect on the national budget, auditors, particularly in Solomon Islands, the Office of the Auditor General reports of 2006 and 2012, the media, as we've seen before, and development partners. As I mentioned, there seems to be a battle between these bureaucrats and development partners on one side and politicians and students themselves and their parents on the other side. While tertiary education policy was developed by the Ministry of Education in Solomon Islands with development partner support in 2010 and 2014, both processes experienced delays to cabinet approval, and for 2010, when this was approved, it was not adhered to anyway by members of parliament. Solomon Islands has a more complicated context because the Solomon Islands College of Higher Education is in the process of transition to the Solomon Islands National University, and there's a broader debate about cost sharing, but having a new national university isn't necessarily going to reduce the government expenditure on overseas tertiary scholarships because of the status issues of having a university education in Fiji. Both in Solomon Islands and Tuvalu, the size of the expenditure problem posed by overseas tertiary scholarships has meant that it has become a trigger in the core policy reform matrix, which is coordinated by the Ministry of Finance and supported by donors. This is possibly the best sign yet that the problem may be being dealt with now that it's become an issue beyond just ministries of education. Development partners also have exerted their influence through partnership agreements and sector-wide approach financing. So there are obviously further challenges to these emerging responses. The question is, can a technical response overcome this political context? How can equitable and education strategy-based budgeting outweigh the incentives to members of parliament of patronage to family and constituents? How can cost sharing occur when there are limited forms of income in Pacific Island societies? I think this can be supported through better policy-based dialogue and communications by education stakeholders and options for credit access. And perhaps Pacific Island countries and development partners need to be explicit about the role of tertiary education in development rather than skipping over it in education strategic planning processes. So in conclusion, there are common characteristics of this problem in three countries that show that education strategy achievement is being undermined and that budget is not aligned to policies and needs. It's an economic problem defined by political and social factors. Resolving the challenge will require political and social engagement with communication combined with technical responses. There's a significant role for development partners. There's been a significant evaluation of development partners' own scholarship programs, but there's been little evaluation so far of Pacific Island government scholarship programs, which this research hopes to fill. There's a significant effect of development partner education financing, influence and pressure, but this could be better coordinated between countries, as, for instance, DFAT's approach in Solomon Islands has differed from the approach in Tuvalu. New directions emerging are obviously engagement with political economy factors, coordinated approaches, and I would recommend partnering with new partners, including the University of the South Pacific themselves, who I think have a role in supporting countries in better performance management of scholars. So I welcome your questions and feedback. Thank you.
Thanks, Stephen, for that really interesting presentation. And just a reminder, if you're interested in tweeting on any of these presentations, the hashtag is just over there on the wall, so feel free to do so. Our third speaker this afternoon is Matthew Dornan. He's a research fellow here at the ANU at the Development Policy Centre. He's interested in aid and development issues in the Pacific. He did a PhD at the Crawford School on Energy Infrastructure and Regulation in Fiji. And he also previously worked for the Australian aid program, particularly in the microstates. And Matthew's talking to us about trends in aid, budget support, conditionality and effectiveness. Thank you.
Right, thank you and good afternoon, everyone. My talk is more focused at the macro level than the previous two presentations, but I will be touching on some of the issues that both presentations have discussed. I'll be exploring trends in official development assistance to Pacific Island countries, and this talk is based on ongoing research that is being funded by the Asian Development Bank and which is to be published in a forthcoming ADB volume. In looking at ODA to the region, the presentation will explore what the data on official development assistance, sourced mainly from the OECD DAC, can tell us about the impact in the Pacific of the scale-up in aid around the world, and also the international aid effectiveness agenda. Following on from that, I'll be discussing direct budget support to Pacific Island governments, which is a subject that has not been studied in the past, at least not in academic circles in the Pacific, and in which in many ways has resulted from that aid effectiveness agenda. These are preliminary results. The research is ongoing, and I literally got back from Tuvalu, having completed the fieldwork last night. So I should also mention that Jonathan Pryke, who is also from the Development Policy Centre, assisted with analysis of the OECD DAC data, but he is in another session presenting on another topic, so he can't be here now. I'll begin briefly by summarising two broad trends relating to development assistance. First is the dramatic scale-up in aid provided to developing countries since 2000. Behind that scale-up is a renewed focus on poverty alleviation, which really dates back to the 1990s, but which was evident in the establishment of the Millennium Development Goals and associated commitments by leaders to increase ODA. The result has been a dramatic increase in official development assistance around the world in real terms. So ODA has risen from $75 billion in the year 2000 to $133 billion 2013. The second change is the rise of the aid effectiveness agenda. That agenda was established and communicated most clearly at Paris in 2005, but I think it continues to be promoted. And I won't go into detail on that agenda. I'm sure most of you are familiar with it. But I will say that my presentation, particularly on budget support, will be touching on principles from that agenda, such as ownership, alignment, harmonisation. As I said, what I want to do in this presentation is to use the OECD DAC data to explore the impact of that aid effectiveness agenda in the Pacific, where that is possible. And then in the second part, I'll be discussing budget support. So most of you will know that the Pacific is the most aid-dependent region in the world. 10 of the 25 countries where aid is highest as a proportion of national income are in the Pacific. But what has happened since the year 2000? The line to look at in this graph is the orange one, and the year 2000 is here. It shows that there has been an increase in official development assistance for different regions, but in the Pacific that increase has been rather modest, and certainly hasn't been matched by increases in other parts of the world. So this graph shows the other regions. And it uses the year 2000 as a base year. Sub-Saharan Africa is in the red. Developing countries as a whole are in the yellow. The Pacific is in the black. And we see that whereas aid to Sub-Saharan Africa has increased dramatically since the year 2000, it has increased, but at a much lower level in the Pacific. And the only region where it has really decreased is in Far East Asia. And given the very high rates of economic growth and poverty alleviation enjoyed by that region over several decades, I think that's very understandable. This graph goes back further to 1970. And what we see is that ODA to the Pacific, again in the black, has remained relatively stable in real terms. It's increased modestly in recent years, but not by very much. Again, compare that to sub-Saharan Africa, where there has been a six-fold increase, and to developing countries as a whole, where there has been a three-fold increase. So, in summary, the Pacific hasn't benefited a great deal, at least in terms of the amount of ODA that is provided from that international scale-up in aid. And in some ways, that is understandable. Absorptive capacity in many Pacific Island countries is often said to be stretched. And, of course, the focus on sub-Saharan Africa is also understandable given the poverty alleviation focus of that scale-up. I think on closer inspection, though, that argument is problematic given that the bulk of the Pacific's population lives in PNG, which, of course, has very poor development indicators. And PNG does not receive very much aid on a per capita basis. On a per capita basis, PNG receives about the same level of aid as do Far East Asian countries on average. And that's shown in this graph. PNG is here. Similarly, if you break down the changes since 2000 to the country level, you see enormous variation between countries, with PNG and Timor-Leste, again, countries in our region where many of the region's poor live, have experienced either very modest growth in ODA or actual declines in ODA in the case of Timor-Leste. In contrast, countries that have relatively high incomes and also high levels of aid per capita, like Tonga and Nauru, have experienced very large increases in official development assistance. I want to move on now and discuss aid fragmentation, which, of course, Joel talked about in his presentation in relation to the health sector. I'll be talking about fragmentation in relation to ODA that a country receives from a number of donors. Fragmentation is generally seen as a bad thing, I think for fairly obvious reasons. It increases transaction costs for government in administering aid. Now, the Pacific is rather unique in the extent to which one donor dominates aid spending, and that's Australia. So in 2012, 52% of official development assistance to the Pacific came from Australia. And there's actually no other region in the world where one donor has enjoys such a large share of development assistance. The US comes close in the Middle East, but it doesn't quite reach that level. I think it's fair to assume that that percentage is going to decline in the future for Australia, given the cuts to the aid program. But nevertheless, Australia will continue to be a very large donor in the Pacific. Now, aid fragmentation can be measured using an indicator of industry concentration, which is called the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index. Basically, it provides a score between 0 and 1, or a higher score indicating less fragmentation. And this has been done in the past for development assistance, but generally it has focused on a particular development partner. So Easterly, for example, used this approach in a paper he published in 2007. For our purposes, we've calculated a reverse Herfindahl-Hirschman index. So basically we consider fragmentation from the perspective of the recipient country only. Not surprisingly, fragmentation in the Pacific is lower than in other regions. That's due, again, to the scale of Australian aid, but it's also due to the fact that there are simply fewer large donors operating in the Pacific. And, of course, it's much more complicated if we look at the country level and if we look at it over time. There's a lot of movement. Nevertheless, I think it's fair to say that most Pacific Island countries enjoy low levels of fragmentation relative to other regions, although there are exceptions such as Timor-Leste. Has there been any improvement in 2000? That's the key question. Or in other words, have aid effectiveness and donor coordination efforts extended to donor decisions around where ODA is provided? And the short answer is no, or at least not across the Pacific. And here we have the average, the unweighted average for Pacific Island countries. To be clear, the DAC data tells us only about fragmentation of where ODA is directed. It says nothing about donor coordination of that assistance at the country level, although I think it is fair to say that where there is a higher degree of fragmentation, where there are more donors operating on the ground, costs associated with donor coordination are going to be higher. Another set of issues that are often discussed in the aid literature relate to volatility and predictability of aid. So aid volatility has been demonstrated to have negative impacts on a range of indicators of importance to us, economic growth, investment, government expenditure. At the same time, most studies have found that aid is actually a very volatile revenue source, and those include studies that have examined the Pacific. So this graph shows ODA volatility for various regions over a number of decades, and ODA here is measured as the coefficient of variation of annual ODA flows. Volatility since 2000 in the Pacific has been higher than in Far East Asia, but it's been lower than in Sub-Saharan Africa. And the graph points to possible improvement in the region, although it's difficult to tell if that's part of a longer-term trend. And this is the country level again. There's a lot of variation between countries. Now, the data on predictability is more concerning in my view. So this analysis is based on a comparison of the forward estimates from development partners with actual country programmable aid in each year. And I've looked at country programmable aid rather than official development assistance because it excludes aid that is by its very nature unpredictable, things like humanitarian responses or emergency responses. Quite clearly, the forward estimates are very inaccurate for the Pacific as a whole. You can see that in this graph. But what we're really concerned about is predictability at the country level, of course, because that's where decision-making by governments occurs. And we find exactly the same story if we look at predictability on a country basis. So these graphs are for Tonga, for Solomon Islands and for Tuvalu. In all three cases, the forward estimates are completely off. There's no obvious improvement since the year 2008, and that's despite the Pacific Aid Effectiveness principles being agreed to, the Cairns Compact, both of which call for greater predictability of aid funds. And this is really concerning, given the importance of aid in these countries. So in the case of Tuvalu, for example, ODA funds around 30% of the government budget. In the case of Solomon Islands, aid funds around 40% of the Ministry of Health budget. So this lack of predictability obviously wreaks havoc with government planning and budgeting, and is an issue which development partners are consistently criticised on by the PFA assessments, the public expenditure and financial accountability assessments. I'm now going to move on and present some preliminary findings regarding budget support in the region, and I hope to present the full findings later in the year. The bulk of this research effort has been concerned with budget support, but unfortunately, because the fieldwork was only just completed, I wasn't able to spend the whole presentation discussing this important issue. Budget support involves channeling funds directly to recipient countries' national treasury, with governments then using those funds through normal budgetary processes. And the importance of budget support varies by donor. AusAid in the last decade has tended to not make great use of budget support, although that has been changing over the last few years. The EU, in contrast, provides between 15 and 20% of its ODA using budget support, although not in the Pacific, I should add. Now, budget support has been advocated as a type of program assistance on the basis that it can increase country ownership of aid by aligning that aid with partner government priorities. It can reduce transaction costs through the harmonisation of assistance, and it can increase accountability to citizens of partner governments. So that's basically what this differed aid policy statement says below. Balanced against those potential benefits, are the risks associated with mismanagement of funds. And that can mean corruption, but it can also simply mean misallocation in the case of tertiary scholarships, which Stephen was just discussing. And budget support has increased in the Pacific in recent years, and that's evident in this graph. I must say that I think the budget support data from the OECD DAC are very, very questionable. So I don't want to put too much on this graph, but I thought I'd put it up there anyway. Now, budget support always has strings attached. It's normally associated with a policy dialogue around sector or national development strategies, and then certain government actions that are consistent with those strategies trigger the payment of budget support from development partners. And here I think there's a tension between the Paris goals of ownership and alignment as opposed to the use of conditionality attached to budget support by development partners in order to promote reform. And in fact, some analysts or some academics view budget support as a continuation of the conditionality of the 80s and the 90s, of which the much criticised structural adjustment programs are best known. And Fraser and Whitfield are two academics who fall into that camp, and I've included a quote here from Whitfield. In the Pacific, Murray and Overton are of a similar view, so they argue that conditionality and reporting requirements associated with what they call the new aid paradigm have led to an inverse sovereignty effect, with Pacific Island countries actually losing control over development policy sovereignty. And budget support is a very important aid modality within that new aid paradigm. And even supporters of budget support, Paul Mosley, for example, refer to the conditions that are attached to budget support as the new conditionality. Where they differ from the authors that I just mentioned is in their view that the new conditionality is markedly different to the conditionality that was associated with those structural adjustment programs in the past. And I think this quote from the EU summarises that position quite clearly. Personally, I'm actually very sympathetic to this argument, especially having interviewed people in the case study countries. So I interviewed donor staff from all the development partners, all the development partners that provide budget support in the Pacific in this format. I also interviewed civil servants and donor agency staff in Solomon Islands, Tonga, Tuvalu, and Kiribati. And I would argue that the new conditionality is very different to conditionality of the past. For one thing, the majority of policy reform conditions attached to budget support are now taken from existing national development plans and strategies. They don't originate with donors, for the most part, and I'll have more to say about that later. Furthermore, the types of conditions that are attached to budget support are in most cases pretty reasonable. So in Tuvalu, for example, the bulk of conditions are based around the recommendations of the 2011 PIFA assessment. So they're really focused on strengthening public financial management systems, proper auditing of public accounts, for example. On top of that, other reported benefits associated with budget support, which came out from the interviews, included the establishment of a policy dialogue, and that was beneficial not just from the perspective of budget support, but also from the perspective of aligning other forms of aid to national planning and strategies, particularly technical assistance. Budget support was said to contribute towards improved donor coordination, implementation of policy reform, often simply because the budget support process raised the profile of reforms, particularly more technical reforms, by placing them in front of Cabinet for approval. And then there's also the strengthening of budget processes by reducing use of parallel systems, so very important in Solomon Islands, and that really means that line ministries are made accountable to the Ministry of Finance as opposed to development partners. And there are actually mixed views from line agencies or line ministries about whether that's a good thing, and that really depended on what the relationship was like between the line ministry and the development partner in the past. But results haven't always been positive. In some instances, policy reforms have been selected and driven by donors, and this has created tensions between development partners and government. Another issue is that donor interaction on budget support has sometimes led to dialogue, but it hasn't actually led to coordination among donors. And this is very evident when where donors insist on their own triggers for budget support, even where these sit outside national plans, and even where they're not consistent with the triggers used by other development partners. In all cases, transaction costs associated with policy dialogue are high, and I think the common assumption that transaction costs fall as a result of moves towards program-led approaches really needs to be revisited. So results have varied, as have the way in which budget support is negotiated in the various countries and the scope of the conditions that have been attached to budget support operations. What is clear is that budget support has been least effective where the new conditionality has involved donor identified and led reform with limited country ownership. That typically led to delays in the reform process. So I'm going to wrap up just by going back to the questions that I asked at the beginning of this presentation. To what extent has the Pacific benefited from the scale-up of international ODA? The answer is not very much, at least not when compared to other regions. Has the Aid Effectiveness Agenda reduced aid fragmentation in the Pacific? Again, when looking at aid allocation to countries, the clear answer is no. Although it's important to note that fragmentation in the Pacific is fairly low in any case. And that is, again, looking at ODA as a whole, not its sectors. Has the Aid Effectiveness Agenda impacted volatility or predictability of ODA flows? Well, especially when predictability is concerned, there's very little predictability of country programmable aid to Pacific Island countries. And as I said, this has adverse implications for government planning and budgeting. And lastly, has budget support contributed to achievement of the objectives of the Aid Effectiveness Agenda? And by this, I'm talking about increasing ownership, aligning aid with partner government priorities, and lowering transaction costs. My preliminary assessment is that budget support has had positive impacts with regards to alignment with partner government priorities, and it has increased partner government ownership, particularly among ministries of finance, of some key reforms. That said, I think the evidence is much more mixed when budget support's impact on transaction costs and also on the predictability of aid flows is considered. But I look forward to presenting the full results later in the year, and I'll finish there. Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to ask the three speakers to come forward and take a seat. And I think you might need to use the mic so that these presentations are being recorded so that your voices can be heard. I'll take questions from the floor, and I can see one hand up already. When you ask a question, could you please state your name and indicate who the question is for, whether it's to an individual on the panel or the panellists in general. So you're first, and then did you have a question after that? Yeah, thank you.
I'm Greg Roberts. I've spent more than 30 years in the Pacific, on both in Australia and Fijian. I'm currently adjunct associate professor at the Fiji School of Medicine and also at the University of New South Wales. What distressed me about the presentations is, particularly with Joel's presentation, is what was missing from the slide. And what's missing from the slide is the indigenous approaches to health. There seemed to be nothing there about existing structures that exist within indigenous cultures. And this is something that we've neglected. We seem to have a blind spot. I'm just wondering why is it that we have this sort of cultural imperialism where we think that ODA and our money is going to solve these problems. I was the Australian team leader of the first project, the first health project in Fiji, in Kindawa. And I wrote a paper which is in international health promotion, which basically said that the project succeeded because it dropped the design and it worked through existing systems, existing provincial systems, district systems. So I'm just wondering, why is it that we have such a blind spot about people's own cultures and how they work themselves, how people live from day to day, the things that mean something to them on a daily basis, their structures. And here we are imposing our own. Now that was 1997 I wrote that paper. And the core lesson in that paper and that whole project was to work through existing systems. And yet I don't see that happening. I'm just wondering why. Can't we see it? Can't we see the existing systems?
That's a great question. Absolutely. I think that is a very fair critique. I would perhaps just push back to say that in some lands, for example, where I spent the most time looking in the health sector, I'm not sure if there is, at the government level, an indigenous health coordination model that is across the various provinces. And there's tension between provinces and even in the development of the sector-wide approach, which was supposed to be putting power back into the government. There was this weird situation of, in terms of budget support, in terms of government ownership, was almost imposed. I mean, it was a situation where donors were imposing national ownership, which obviously goes against what national ownership is supposed to be. So I think, based on my question, is have we almost gone so far along this pathway that the indigenous laws aren't even necessarily known or endorsed by government officials themselves? So you almost have to go beyond government officials back down to community to find out what those indigenous models of coordination and collaboration might be. And I guess that's my fear, because we've almost gone too far down the road that to recapture them might be a whole step change of governance completely as opposed to tinkering.
I could argue that point that maybe we've taken them too far down.
Absolutely.
Okay, thanks for that. Next question.
My name is Richard Curtin. I'm a research associate at the Development Policy Centre. I'd like to thank the three speakers for very enjoyable presentations. I think the combination of evidence and providing feedback on aid effectiveness and local expenditures are a crucial part of what we're about. The two questions I'd like to ask. One is of Joel about the WHO. What is the political economy of how the WHO gets its funding? And does that influence the way it feels it needs to have a series of extras, increase the numbers of meetings? And of Stephen, I'd like to ask, this planned graduate destination surveys, which Bedford's going to do in the Solomons, is that going to include the graduates from overseas as well as domestic graduates? That's an obvious omission. The assumption is that these graduates will come back and go into employment, but if the public sector is already oversubscribed in terms of their employees, many graduates may be unemployed or underemployed. And I think the other question was, it's very much one option, very much up to the USP to specify that they want students of a certain standard because ones that their resources are being misused because students are coming that are not well qualified. They do have a foundation here. That's one obvious way to weed people out, but perhaps it could be done before that.
Sure, strictly on the WHL funding, that certainly is a big part of the situation. I don't know the exact numbers, but it's something of the magnitude of 20-30% of WHO funding globally is core budget support. The rest is earmarked for various projects. That's why we have WHO lurching from global issue to global issue. And why you have a situation, for example, in the Pacific in the late 2000s, where they were spending 3 to 4 times more on HIV programs in the Pacific than non-communicable diseases, even though mortality from HIV is essentially zero, mortality from diabetes was massive. So that is quite a bit of the funding that comes from US government and British government and Australian government that is earmarked for certain programs does dictate the fragmentation within WHO. So I think we're all to blame for some of that, but I also think WHO hasn't quite push back on that and said we can't function unless we have a more coordinated approach.
Thank you. Thank you, Richard. I think it's very important that there's an updated Tracer survey of graduates. The last one that I know of was several years ago in Solomon Islands. And I think USP should be commended for piloting employment transition support for returned USP graduates. But it's reassuring that others agree that the focus should be on USP's role, given the significant impact of political influence on the selection of students and their performance at USP. I guess also an issue that we face in looking at labour market transitions in Solomon Islands is that tracer surveys of graduates is the main form of research that we're able to do, but for the majority of participants in the labour force, those who are transitioning between the system of culture and informal livelihoods, it's more challenging to do that research on what pathways there are, and as far as we know, the pathways have in fact reduced over time for people to access tertiary education, informal employment, and we need to make a case to government and donors to expand those pathways.
Oh, hi, I'm Katie Richmond from the University of Sydney. I guess my question is for Matthew, but the panel. We heard in the plenary that there was a study done in Cambodia that said that aid had in fact reduced governments. And just looking at budget support, he then went on to say that a very small percentage of aid is given as direct budget support, although he didn't attribute that to the governance issue. Just looking at budget support and with the sustainable development goals coming up and with the sort of discussions around having a governance indicator, but then on the other hand, having donors such as, you know, DFAT saying that they want value for money and immediate results, and that's how they'll be funding their programs. I'm just wondering how you see that sort of tension playing out of if we're going to be looking at good governance and the requirements of that mean that perhaps service delivery is not as immediate if we're going through national systems, and then, you know, meeting donor requirements and the MDGs.
I'm not sure how to cover that question. I guess, first of all, when I talked about the potential for CIS, for example, any country that says budget support, the very robust checks about country systems and so forth, using their systems, the has its own processes for running those systems. Sorry, is that what you were asking about? Or
well, just that going through national systems often means that the services are slower to get to the ground. So it's that sort of effectiveness of the aid of money and value for money versus good governance, which requires building national systems, which may take.
You're absolutely right. There's a tension there. I guess my view would be, simply there's been such a long history of these parallel systems and finding them to be done, so I think the budget support should be given a chance.
That said, budget support is a very small portion of aid. So, for example, in Tonga, I think it's 4% of aid received is from budget support. While I think the scope for an increase, this is a situation where all aid will be channeled through budget support. So, I think there is a balance to be had there. Obviously, as government systems or government service delivery becomes more effective, budget support should increase. And I think that has happened in some cases, just like the sign up, for example.
If I could just comment briefly, I think there is scope for development policy operations, as they're called in World Bank terms, to achieve results quickly, and it's all about the shaping of policy triggers. So rather than policy triggers that are based on delivering services over the long term, if the policy triggers focused on reforms that leverage wider government budget that are achievable in the coming year, then I think it's actually a greater scope for achieving the results of that kind of through budget support than through peripheral and parallel projects in terms of changes within government.
Can I just also quickly that it's not necessarily a case of either or as well. Obviously, there are competence between the two, and where budget support is provided on a sectoral basis, that puts the development partner in a good position to develop the programs that you think are important for your increasing service delivery in a sector where you can't have some programs like
that. Okay, we probably have time for one very quick question and answer, and you had your hand up first. Just wait for the mic, please. It's coming.
Well, it is me. It's not so much a question, it's just a couple of comments. And thank you very much for those.
I don't know if you get to make comments.
I'm telling you.
You better make it a question.
I'm telling you, I live in Solomon Islands and have lived in the Pacific for 50 years in various parts of it. I was here before independence. Okay, it's a question, but I just want to say this. Historically, this budget support thing, that was what we set out to get rid of by becoming independent. We had budget support, all the colonies did, and it was interpreted as interference from London or wherever. When we got rid of it, we were delighted. Now we want it back again. What for? Okay, just the use of Tuvalu as an exemplar of anything. Tuvalu is so small and so peculiar. Most of the families in Tuvalu behave like little transnational corporations. They've all got people overseas and they're managing their resources like that. It is very small and doesn't really compare very well. And lastly, those descriptions of the medical health system in Solomon Islands and the education system are spot on. Those systems are broken. The VIPs go for medical treatment in Sydney by air, flying to and fro. The VIPs send their children overseas on scholarships. Those systems are broken. How are we going to sort it out? I'm not quite sure, but it's a very serious situation. Thank you.
Thanks for that comment. Now I'm going to ask the last question, and that is to each of the three panellists, and you've got approximately 30 seconds to answer. If you had a magic wand that you could wave over the institutions and the donors and the partner governments to get them to do one thing differently, what would it be? Matthew, you first.
I guess I would say actually coordinate with one another and the people I interviewed were pleased that donors were talking to each other because of these discussions relating to budget support, but they also made very clear that didn't mean that the donors were cooperating, but I think there's just sort of the underlying incentives for each donor aren't there to actually compromise in their programs in any large way in order to ensure that they're well coordinated.
Joel?
Okay, I can agree with what Matt says, but I'd also suggest that all of us who have our ambition to be the director of our own NGO institute mechanism should put that in our pockets and work with existing mechanisms rather than create our own joint living associates on the director.
Stephen.
Well, I guess if it's a message for Pacific Island governments on this topic, it's to ensure evidence-based policy development with alignment to a policy by budget implementation and ensure compliance with merit-accredited selection processes for tertiary scholarships.
There you have it. Final words. Please thank our three wonderful speakers and thanks for being a great audience.
been listening to a podcast from the Development Policy Centre. For more information on our work, visit our website at devpolicy.anu.edu.au. To join the conversation on Australian aid, Papua New Guinea and the Pacific, and global development policy, visit our blog at devpolicy.org. At the blog, you can also sign up to our newsletter for all the latest updates or connect with us on social media. Thanks for listening.